Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation that I hope you find as interesting as I do with some expert on my favorite subjects of food and taste. And today, I'm doubly excited to have with me in the studio here in Bushwick one of my favorite food people. If you follow us on Twitter at all or you follow me at Kitchen Sense, you know that there's no one I'd rather hang or eat with than at Bonnie Stern. I knew her before she was at Bonnie Stern when she was just the Bonnie Stern. Welcome to Brooklyn. Bonnie.
It's so great to be here.
We should tell you a little bit. If this show were broadcasting in Canada, which I guess due to the miracle of technology, it can be. It sounds like it's happening in Canada as much as anywhere. How would people know who you are?
If they know who I am.
Which everyone in Canada does.
Right. You're so kind. Probably through television and radio and mostly my cookbooks.
Your cookbooks. Mm-hmm. And all of that grew out of a cooking school that you had for many years in Toronto?
I opened a cooking school in 1973, and it was when food was just, well, before food was starting to
before
be
people done. Ate.
Yes,
you opened a cooking school before
exactly,
anyone ate.
That's
right.
Exactly what I did, and I don't even know why or how, but I did, and sort of everything grew up with me, and it was very exciting. It's very exciting to be in Toronto now, but then, you know, sometimes I think about what was in Toronto then, and there wasn't much. There weren't that many restaurants.
So what possessed you to open a cooking school then?
I love to eat, and I love to read, and I was going to be a librarian. Uh-huh. And then I decided, after graduating from university, to go to chef school just to take a break.
Okay, from academics. Or from getting a job.
I wasn't that academic, right. But I love to cook, and I thought, before I went to librarian school, I would just take a break, and I would do something practical, because my father was a chartered accountant, and so everything we did had to be very practical, and I thought I could just always be a good cook. And so I went to chef training, and then I stayed for restaurant management, and then I got terrified to ever open a restaurant. But I would work with the school that I went to do special demos, and I started, after I got over my shyness, I started to love teaching and telling people about food and making food more fun for people, because before that it was really like a job to cook dinner every night. Mm-hmm. And so I seemed to be very good at that, and it was fun. Very fun.
So describe what was going on in Toronto, but also just mm-hmm. in the food world in 1973 when this all began. How would you characterize that period?
No one talked about food.
Okay.
We knew food was getting to be very big when you were in a line at the bank and people mentioned a restaurant or
right.
something like
that.
But no one
then.
Ever did anything like that. There weren't very many restaurants that you could... There were a lot of ethnic restaurants, and there still are. You know, Toronto's one of the most multicultural cities, or the most multicultural mm-hmm. cities in the world. And so, Chinese, Italian, huge Chinese population, huge Italian population. Mm-hmm. And so there were lots of different kinds of restaurants always in Toronto. But to go out for a nice dinner, there was not that many places. Mm-hmm. And hotel restaurants and a couple of freestanding restaurants were just starting in Toronto when
so,
I did that.
So before we got to today, when mm-hmm. we have, folks who are listening will know David Chang's name and Danielle Ballou, who
yes.
have opened mega restaurants in Toronto.
Right.
But before then,
mm-hmm.
something else had gone on, obviously, in the last 30X years.
Yes.
Give us a little bit of the trajectory about Toronto and Canada. And again, I know that you are Canada's Julia Child or whatever.
Well,
yeah,
I'm very short, too.
You're very short,
I don't know.
Right? But at a time, I think, when we're talking, the food world in the world was smaller, at least in North America.
Yes, definitely,
I mean, you knew Julia Child. You knew James Beard. It was, they were not as these icons as far away.
Short and old.
Yeah, we'll get to something else later, but because I know how you eat, but we'll hold that one for that insult for the end of the show.
Okay,
so talk a little bit about the history, what's gone on. What went on before the current craze in Toronto and elsewhere about food?
Well, I think that some people started to open restaurants and chefs started to become, there was no such thing as a celebrity chef or anything like that. But people like Jamie Kennedy and Michael Statlander opened a restaurant called Scaramouche. Mm-hmm. And that started to become, you know, sort of exciting and different, and people were interested. There were the three small rooms where chefs were, you know, starting to train other people, and then other people started to open more restaurants, and then smaller restaurants started to open. But for a long time, if you didn't have a lot of money to open a restaurant, you know, you weren't going to sort of do that. The ethnic restaurants were still very popular, and then we had sort of upscale Chinese and upscale Italian. And it was really getting to be very exciting, and people started to have, you know, be on television, do food on television, have cooking events where people demoed cooking.
Which
and
was a new thing.
Schools, that was very new.
You mean that people didn't do that on their way home from school every day like they do now?
Yes, exactly.
A cooking demonstration?
Exactly. You know, it was fun. And now, actually, there's a lot of cooking classes that are corporate events as opposed to learning how to really cook. You know, it's an interesting thing to talk about and for me to see home cooking and what it is now. And it's a little bit different than it was.
So describe that a little more. How is home cooking different?
Well, home cooking kind of evolved where people were cooking, starting to get interested in cooking because Julia Child and through her books, and people started to get excited to buy better ingredients and to cook fancier food maybe that they saw in the restaurants. And that was exciting.
There's a great passage in Betty Fussell's memoir where she talks about competitive era of cooking, where you had to out bourguignon your neighbors or your friends or whatever in some way.
Right. That was sort of fun, but also very stressful for people, which developed into the stressful Martha Stewart idea, where people actually were terrified to entertain because they felt insecure
because they didn't make the paper for the invitations and that kind of thing.
Exactly. Which, you know, there's so much good about everything that's happening in food, and yet people sometimes are too stressed to cook for other people and too stressed to entertain, which is sad.
Still, you know? You think? Yeah. Because of the, well, so much now. So you were a cooking teacher who, and you were a mom, and you had to cook dinner every day, and you sort of related to people in a very home way. But now the celebrities of the cookbook world and television are mostly chefs, for the most part, or even just entertainers in some way. No image of mom cooking dinner or what do we serve Tuesday night. It's always about how do we impress everyone on Saturday night.
Exactly. And it is sort of sad. I mean, I think people are still cooking, but I think also large companies started to make people feel more insecure about it too, because they started to make mothers and fathers feel, well, if you've got any spare time, don't bother cooking. We can cook for you. The big food companies would say in their advertising, we'll cook for you. And then you can go and do other things with your kids, exercise with your kids, you know, be with your kids here, be with your kids there. And that actually cooking the food for your family wasn't as important as doing other things with them. But actually cooking with your kids and showing them where food comes from and how it gets in the table is such an important part of this whole food movement. And I'm a little bit anxious about that that's being lost. But I think it's starting to become revived again in different ways.
Hmm. If you're listening at home and you have questions for us, you can email us, of course, at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or if you prefer to tweet as your main form of communication, you can tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. We're happy to answer your questions, if not on this show, on the next one, or maybe just a tweet back. So
people have been tweeting, by the way, that they want to come to New York with us because they've been following our tweets of where we're going to eat and everything, and their dream is to be part of it.
Well, we do get around.
We
do consume an embarrassing amount of food,
it's
I have
so
to say.
Embarrassing. Yeah. So embarrassing.
So we are – let's talk a little bit about – Toronto now, because I think I think this is a phenomenon that's happening in Canada. It's happening in America. It's happening in Denmark. It's happening in all sorts of places that aren't really Italy and France. And what mm-hmm. I think is happening is this search for a local cuisine to call their own. You mentioned how first there was a generation of chefs probably trained in Europe or at least in a European style, mm-hmm. and then they begat mm-hmm. another generation of young people interested and passionate about food. And I feel personally, and tell me if you agree, that we're in this moment of reaping the seeds or the fruit of those seeds that in these days with young chefs. I mean, here we are in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you know, looking exactly. at this incredible Roberta's Enterprise, and there's a claiming our own food happening, certainly city by city. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that phenomenon in Canada, in Toronto in particular.
Well, it's definitely happening in Canada, and it's happening all across the country. And farmers markets are opening, and people are starting to open restaurants who have never had any formal training.
Oh.
But what's interesting about it is that, you know, when you have formal training, you're somehow stuck with that in your head, whereas if you don't have it, you can be a little bit more open and experimentative, and sometimes mm-hmm. that works great and sometimes it doesn't, mm-hmm. but it's a good experiment. And the restaurants are sort of smaller, so people can open them and they don't have to have a huge amount of backing behind them,
uh-huh.
except maybe Danielle Ballou and David Chang.
Right. We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Right.
And
maybe Danielle, but not when David Chang started. That's
no,
for
no,
sure.
no. I'm talking about Toronto.
In Toronto, yeah.
Yeah. And it's exciting to see that. It's exciting to see that grow and to be using local ingredients and to be proud of our local ingredients. Uh-huh. And I think sometimes it goes to a little bit huge extent where, you know, people again are intimidated a little bit to cook. But I think the whole thing about cooking at home is that it's so easy to cook. What really kills me about this whole thing where people are buying a lot of their food and going out to so many restaurants because they don't want to cook and they think cooking is so hard mm-hmm. because it's more complicated in any restaurant, even basic restaurants, it seems complicated, that cooking is so easy, and you know that, and everybody who cooks knows that
right.
cooking is so much fun and fulfilling and easy.
And why do you think it's important to cook regardless of how easy or hard it is? Do you think it's important? And what do you think people gain or learn by cooking or having that relationship with food? I mean, can't we just read about it and watch it on TV and go out and eat?
I think feeding people, like making anything, and feeding people is one of the most wonderful things that you can do. And I think a lot of chefs feel that way too, and mm-hmm. that's why they get into it. When you feed people, it becomes part of them. You know, the things that you make becomes part of their life. And it's so rewarding to give people things that you're making either in front of them or with them or beside them, not just where food comes from with your children, but also friends. And mm-hmm. it's very, very special. Mm-hmm. It's different than going to a restaurant and having a great meal, which I love to do too.
Do you cook for yourself if you're alone?
I do. I cook very simply for myself, but right. I do. And I think that cooking, knowing how to cook, and of course, the more you cook, the easier it gets, is really important, because that's the only way to be self-sufficient and to,
right.
you know, really be able to take care of yourself in any situation.
So Michael Pollan has just come out with a book about the importance of cooking that isn't really a cookbook, but mm-hmm. is also about some tie to not just understanding food intellectually, but knowing mm-hmm. how it works, understanding where it comes from, somehow nourishing yourself, not just others, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. a wonderful mm-hmm. piece of that. But he thinks we're fat in America. There's an obesity epidemic because we don't cook. What do you think about that?
The book just crossed my desk, but I came to New York, so I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But I agree with it. I do agree with it, because you know what's in your food. When you cook for yourself, you know what is actually in the thing that you're making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you eat food, and I'm not putting down restaurants. I love them. But,
of course.
You know, fat, sugar, really, salt, you know.
You just don't cook like that at home.
You don't.
Right.
You would never put the same amount of any of those things in the food that you would eat, that
which
you would make yourself.
Which is why food in restaurants sometimes is so delicious.
That is exactly why. I mean, that's the easy way, really, to make your food so delicious. But even if the food is delicious and you add a little bit more of all of that, it makes it more delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Love. Don't chefs call that love?
What? Butter and salt?
Yes.
Our love? And bacon?
Yes.
What did chefs do before bacon? Was there a time before bacon?
I don't know. I don't know if there was ever a time before bacon.
We are talking with Bonnie Stern, who is Canada's favorite food columnist and cookbook author, formerly of the Bonnie Stern Cooking School. You can read her in the National Post weekly. We'll be right back. We are here in Brooklyn at Bushwick, and you're listening to Taste Matters.
You're listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on heritageradionetwork.org.
Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
You are back with Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Bonnie Stern, Canada's favorite source of all things food, all information food, and all recipes. Let's talk a little bit. You do a ton of traveling. I've been fortunate to do some of it with you. And you're always looking for recipes to write about for people to cook, even, you know, in whether you're in Turkey or you're in Vietnam or you're here in New York. And watching you explore a dish that you're enjoying, you can sort of see a translation process happen in your mind about how you're going to take something and make it doable for a general audience who is not as food obsessed as we are. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Can I talk about it? I didn't even see myself doing it. So that's very funny. I do do it. And I'm always looking for a way to make a dish easy for people to reproduce at home. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was always very funny at my cooking school was that I used to have a lot of chefs come in and guest teach. And people... my students would not mind at all if they used a ton of cream and butter and eggs and cheese and like tons of salt, and they would eat their food and take their recipes and everything. And the recipes would be quite complicated. Mm-hmm. But if people came to one of my classes, what they wanted was things to be able to make easily, quickly, and taste that good. And I don't exactly know how I came to be able to do it, but I do feel that I do that quite well. And when I taste a dish, I mean, there's certain things that I know that wouldn't work at home, but those aren't the ones I concentrate on. And usually, you know, I can usually sort of disregard them right away. Mm-hmm. But there's so many things that are really easy to reproduce at home and taste wonderful and be a family favorite and add to people's... And you're going to ask me which one...
I'd like some current ones that you're interested in. Something that... I mean, and this trip to New York, have you seen anything you think you're going to develop into a recipe?
Oh, tons.
Okay. Now she's flipping through her notebook where all the secrets reside.
Yeah. But, you know, you don't like to kind of... they're just sort of ideas that come.
What are some ideas?
That you can do it. When we were at the Schmortesburg the other day, there was a great double-down kugel sandwich.
A kugel being a noodle pudding.
A noodle pudding. Okay. And they did it sort of in a flat dish, and then they made a sandwich out of it, cut it into pieces, baked it, and made sandwiches out of it with cream cheese and fried onions and apricot jam. And it was really, I thought, delicious. But I thought also, you know, you could just put all those ingredients in your kugel and it would be a really easy thing to make and it would be absolutely delicious too.
Right.
Or, of course, you could make tons of sandwiches out of it, but it gets a little bit more complicated.
And they would not fall into the low-fat, low-sugar category.
Well, you certainly could, but usually if it was just sort of medium, mm-hmm. you know, I did write a number of cookbooks for the Heart and Stroke Foundation with delicious food, I thought, with lower fat contents. Mm-hmm. But you can also do things with just sort of a normal fat, sugar, salt content that are really delicious and wonderful. So, I mean, that was just sort of one idea. I'm trying to take a look. So, you know, there were some great grilled cheese sandwiches at that same event. And I didn't do any sort of normal food yet, but okay. I have to go through all the things.
I
but
think
yes,
many people, including
ideas.
Dr. Nathan mm-hmm. Goldstein, would think grilled cheese is as normal a food as you can get.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean normal. I meant high fat.
Right, mm-hmm. of course. So let's get back to Toronto specifically, mm-hmm. because we were recently on a panel, or I recently moderated a panel that you were in the audience for, but it's a topic we've talked a lot about, and it is this idea of making a local food culture, both of the diners and the chefs and the producers and the artisans who are all part of a dynamic food culture, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I often think of something Alan Richman, another mm-hmm. mutual friend of ours, mm-hmm. said, that Las Vegas was a great restaurant town, but it was a terrible food town. And I think that mm-hmm. really gets to the heart of what mm-hmm. makes a dynamic food culture. It isn't just great restaurants. And this arrival of some foreign interest, which from our perspective, from my perspective here as someone who grew up in Toronto and also sort of made my career in New York, is a sign that people are paying attention to what's happening in Toronto. If David Chang and Danielle Ballou want to mm-hmm. open a restaurant mm-hmm. there, I mean, I would consider that a welcome thing, even if it's not the first place I go to dinner. But talk about the culture, what's brewing there, and what you feel about this attention and what's good and what's bad. And I mean, just off the top of your head.
Well, of course, there's good and bad to everything like this that happens, and Canadians tend to be very insecure and insecure of America, you know, and all the power that you have here and
power
influence. And Canadians want to be recognized by Americans. So on one point, you know, having Danielle and David coming in and opening up these really wonderful, big, glitzy kind of restaurants is very comforting and exciting.
Reassuring.
But on the other hand, I think Canadians are also a little bit protective of their space. Mm-hmm. You know, we have far fewer people. Mm-hmm. You know, there aren't that many people who would go out for expensive meals. So I think maybe people worry about that. Mm-hmm. I think people worry about... I don't know that they were worried so much about the attention that they would, that these two restaurants or chefs would get. I think more just about their own turf. Mm-hmm. But I think that they also felt that it was exciting. And oh, the other thing too, of course, staff. You
sure,
know, it's very hard to get restaurant staff. And so, you know, these guys would come in and maybe take away some of their key people. Which
it's hard everywhere. There's
exactly,
no place that it's easy. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think it was a little bit of push and pull. Yeah. And I think what happened specifically was that Toronto restaurant reviewer gave Momofuku number one in Toronto after it only was open for 8 weeks. And I think that if he hadn't done that, there wouldn't have been quite the uproar and insecurity
right.
and everything. But then a food reviewer from Montreal, who I think is really excellent, but she got all defensive for Toronto.
Okay. And that would be Leslie Chesterman, whom you can follow. Yeah.
And I think she's great, actually, to follow. And she's, I think, a great food writer and uh-huh. restaurant reviewer. But it created a big fervor
right.
everywhere. Like,
which is what led
New
to
York
this panel.
Too.
We thought we
exactly.
had to really address it and see what we thought. But if you had advice for Toronto, which I know you're full mm-hmm. of sometimes or think
yeah.
about, and what the chefs there might take or might want to do because of your experience around the world, like, what do you think would be good advice for chefs? And I know they ask you these sorts of things. This is not first time that question has come up.
Well, I think the funny thing is that, you know, we want to be recognized and yet then get defensive when people come in. But we're never going to be on the world's 50 best restaurant list if people who are the judges don't come to Toronto and eat. So I think that one, the symposium was great because it brought a lot of food people to Toronto and exposed all the restaurants, not just those two restaurants, but exposed all the restaurants. And I think what happened also was a lot of magazines started to write about Toronto, and not just those two restaurants, but all the Toronto restaurants. And it brought a lot of attention to Toronto, which theoretically is what we all want.
Right.
But the Canadian psyche is a little bit kooky sometimes, you know, that's very emotional as opposed to realistic or whatever. Mm. And I think that the chefs have to travel more, and I think that they have to go to good restaurants or restaurants that they aspire to and find out what's going on more in the world. I think that that's a really important thing.
One thing we've talked about, and this is, again, another theme that comes up a lot, and it's this idea of what is Toronto cuisine? How would you identify it? What ought it to be? In New York, people are wrestling with this right now. I'm actually about to do a couple of panels and a paper, in fact, about this search for an authentic New York experience in a city that is made up of so many different people from so many different places. And here we have 11 Madison Park at a very high level. We have Carbone sort of reclaiming an Italian-American past, which couldn't be anywhere but in New York in the essence that it's doing that. What do you think are the elements of Toronto cuisine? That ought to cohere into something, even if it's not now, but in the future.
I think Toronto chefs are really excited about the nose-to-tail experience. Mm-hmm. We're a little bit behind, you know, things that start in other places end up in Toronto, maybe not as far behind as we used to be. maybe we're a couple of months behind, besides a couple of years.
Right. Well, the whole world has gotten so connected, the chef world, the Twitter and
email. It's
much email
faster
and,
to get everything.
People know what Rene Redzepi is doing in Copenhagen and Toronto before some of his diners in the dining room know.
Okay. I do have a funny story about Rene after one of those recipes that I redid for home use. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think that it goes through stages, and I think that ethnic restaurants are starting to open that use local ingredients, which I think is really important, which is something that David Chang is doing, you know, using our ingredients with his food.
Do any of the ethnic flavors and things find their way into other less ethnic restaurants?
It's funny. It's starting to, but people at first with this nose to tail were a little bit afraid to, you know, start using ethnic ingredients. And I think now things are kind of settling down a little bit, and people are realizing that if it's mostly local, you know, that's okay. I mean, we were always using probably lemon juice and serving French wine, so I don't
know. Of course. You're not going to be growing citrus in Canada anytime soon. Not the Canada I've been. Well, maybe actually the way the climate's going.
Exactly. Right? Well, I don't know. It's cold right now. It's freezing in spring, but snowing in
here
Toronto.
Too, right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what were you going to say? What recipe?
What I was going to say about Rene, you know, we went to Noma a couple of times, and he serves this wonderful pot, like sort of a cheese, or I don't even know what it was, in a pot.
A flower pot.
A flower pot, and then puts the earth on top of it, right?
Which is not earth, but rye crumbs or something?
Rye crumbs, and he makes his own bread for it, and he uses his own seeds in it, and then he crumbles it and toasts it and puts it on top of this cheese mixture, and then puts the vegetables that come from his special farmer, you know, inside, and it looks like a flower pot, and then you pull out the flowers, and there'll be a radish or there'll be a carrot underneath. And so I thought this would be like a fantastic thing to do at home, because you could just get a little flower pot and you could make some kind of cheese spread, you know, really anything, goopy or hummus
or
anything.
Buy it and stick it in there.
Exactly. Yeah, right. And then you could take some rye bread like pumpernickel and, you know, chop it up and add some seeds and toast it and put it on top, and it would look adorable, and then put the vegetables in. And it looked great. Like, it was just, and people went crazy. And, you know, I did it in all kinds of classes, and everybody was doing it at home, and it was terrific. And then Rene came to Toronto, and actually I was really, like, I had pictures of it on my phone and everything, and I didn't know whether to show him or not. And you said, no, show him. And so I showed him the picture, and he was just delighted that people were sort of making this thing at home. And then he said to me, he was so excited, and he said to me, but like, so you made your own rye bread for the crumbs. And I said, no, no, I didn't make my own rye bread for the crumbs. You buy it, you know. Oh, he said, oh, it was very sweet.
Hysterical. Because that really would be, wonderful. Right, what could be a 25-page recipe in his book.
That would take years.
Right, and skills that you'd have to develop over many, many generations.
Exactly.
Right. Well, for that, I guess, Bonnie, we are grateful to have you because you are there to take these ideas and make them not just doable, but delicious. And one of the things about your recipes that everyone I know, and everyone I know has your recipes in your books, will agree is that your food is always amazingly delicious. In fact,
that's so sweet. Thank you.
The first time, after knowing you for so long, I was so nervous to go to dinner the first time at your house because I really wanted the food to be good. Because you know you know someone before you know, and you think it's going to be, and it's just everything you make is just wonderful and delicious and beautiful. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well,
thank you.
That is heartfelt.
Cry.
Don't cry on the air. It'll get all messy in here.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to be talking. So thank you for being with us in Bushwick. It's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, we are talking with another mutual friend. It's funny how radio brings out all of the friends from all over New York, too. John Agur from Israel, who's a great food editor, runs a magazine whose name I won't pronounce, Halachan, something like that.
I don't know.
Anyway, but doesn't matter. Doesn't impact the fact that she's a great, knowledgeable person about another place with an incredible food scene going on, really discovering its roots, which is Israel, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and all of the parts from north to south. So we'll be happy to talk to her. In the meantime, next time you go out to dinner, think about how you might make what you're tasting at home.
Yes, that's
what you should do, because, of course, taste matters.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.